KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino. Thanks for being with us. Up front this week, a conversation with Senator Ben Ray Lujan about all of the activities going on in Washington. Senator, I want to start with the infrastructure plans in Congress. Give us what you see as the top benefits for New Mexico.
Most certainly, Fred. It's been an absolute honor to serve the state of New Mexico as one of their two United States senators, and especially getting to work so quickly and aggressively, passing the American Rescue Plan to provide investment for folks back in New Mexico, including the child tax credit, and helping to get more support for our schools as well to help them safely reopen, and also to work on something called a bipartisan infrastructure package. This was a priority of President Biden, but it was a priority to many of us. The U.S. Senate already took action, and we passed this package, which is about $1.2 trillion, one of the most significant infrastructure investments in American history. And what this means for New Mexico is about $2.5 billion specific to investments in roads, another $255 million for bridges, $355 million for water and wastewater infrastructure. And one of the areas that I worked diligently on was including investment for fast, affordable internet and connectivity investment back home. And the state's estimated to receive about $750 million once this package passes the U.S. House of Representatives and is signed into law by the president. Those are just some of the benefits that are included here. There are many others, many of them very robust, but those, I would say, are the top lines that most people in New Mexico have been talking about most.
Okay, and you did address the challenge of passing this in the House. Give me your thoughts on some Democrats who said that they will not vote for the bipartisan infrastructure bill until there's an agreement on a larger Democratic bill that includes some priorities other than physical infrastructure.
So our colleagues back in the U.S. House of Representatives are working on passing the bipartisan infrastructure bill and also President Biden's Build Back Better package, which provides investments like expanding the child tax credit, provides support for making child care more affordable, would result in the largest tax cut for middle class families in the history of the country, require the negotiation of prescription drug prices to lower those costs for the American people, and reinvest those savings back into Medicare to help get families vision care, hearing care, and dental care. Immigration reform advocacy that I've been working towards, so that way we provide certainty to so many dreamers and TPS, farm workers, essential health workers, folks across America, and even investments with modernizing our ports of entry, which is hard infrastructure that's still included in that package as well. Our colleagues are working to have certainty that both these initiatives get adopted. And, you know, that's something that I respect. And we know that in New Mexico, our communities and we as a state will benefit from investments in hardworking middle-class families and those working to get into the middle class and help lift more families out of poverty. It'll also help us with child well-being. As we know, when the Casey Foundation scores child well-being in New Mexico, we are not doing as well as many other states across America, but because of the American Rescue Plan, because of the investments in Build Back Better, we are climbing those charts, and I'm excited to see the growth that is happening for the well-being of families back home. So critically important to pass both of these, and again, I'm optimistic. These packages will get sent to the president before the end of the year, and I'm hopeful before the end of the month.
Okay. As you know, Senator, the larger bill that you talked a little bit about there in your answer is going to be cut significantly if there's any chance of passage. Give me your top priorities in this bill to keep, even if it means funding the priorities for, let's say, you know, 5 years instead of 10 years. That would be one approach to cut the total amount.
Well, the package is being negotiated. President Biden and his team are negotiating with Leader Schumer and Speaker Pelosi, with House Democrats and Senate Democrats. Of course, we've heard a lot about the work that Senator Sinema and Senator Manchin are also doing in that particular area to address concerns they have. This bill is very important. I don't know that there are provisions in here that I would single out that I would like to see reduced per se, Fred. But the essence of this package with child tax credits, the child daycare affordability provisions, addressing pollution in America and reducing emissions for our response with the climate crisis, which also creates job opportunities at home, and then reducing prescription drug prices and making investments in Medicare for vision care, hearing care, and dental care. I think those are some of the most important provisions that are in here and that I'm hopeful that we're going to see preserved. You know, immigration reform must be included, and some of the packages I fought for to help with modernization with our ports of entry in New Mexico as well. So many important provisions here, but nonetheless, we're going to be working diligently over the next month or so until this package is adopted, and keep negotiating and fighting for what makes a big difference back in New Mexico.
You know, you've done such a comprehensive job of talking in a very short amount of time about some of the provisions in this, which are widely supported by the American public. We've seen, you know, some interesting photo op opportunities where folks are trying to make their point. Probably the one that got the most attention was for folks going out to talk to Joe Manchin on his houseboat. You know, that they were on their own watercraft right next to his houseboat. And I'm wondering, you know, we all know that public opinion does have an impact. For folks who are listening to this right now and may have feelings about this effort, which is just something that even some opponents argue is long overdue, investing in infrastructure, what is effective for people to do to get involved in this?
Oh, I think raising their voices in every way that they can. You know, we all have to make sure that we're treating each other respectfully and treating each other with dignity as well, Fred, and I think that's always important. Even when we're talking to friends that have a different perspective or a different point of view, when we're able to have a conversation as opposed to yelling at one another, I think more people listen, and so I would encourage that. And that's really a New Mexico value, treating people with respect and dignity, the importance of civility, and having conversations even when we disagree on the subject matter. What I appreciate with constituents with me is when I'm at the grocery store or grabbing a cup of coffee or, you know, having a breakfast burrito, whatever it may be, going out for a bike ride, you know, at church, not during church, but, you know, before church or after church, people feel comfortable talking to me. Whether we're in communities, we're holding coffee on your corners or small gatherings, as I've had the honor of traveling the state of New Mexico over these last 10 months or so, every way that we can, write letters, send emails, join us on radio shows. Just, you know, come on by and just chat everywhere that we can. And I always encourage that. And I know I make myself available to constituents, and I really enjoy what I learn from them. Even when we have a little bit of a disagreement, you know, we come out of there, finding a path forward and seeing what we have in common, not just what we don't agree on as well.
I only have about a minute and a half left here, and I want to ask you one more question that is unrelated to infrastructure, at least in terms of those specific bills. It's related in the larger picture. But do you think, Senator, that there's any hope of getting away at some point from this situation where Congress has only had temporary fixes for funding the government, for the debt ceiling limit? I think a lot of people are really frustrated by that uncertainty, and I'm wondering your thoughts on how we can get away from that.
So you're hitting on something that's so important, Fred, and the premise of your question is something that I fundamentally agree with, which is the Congress, working with the president, has the responsibility to fix this once and for all, so that there are not political games, there's not a partisan bickering back and forth that is dictating the terms of these conversations. when the full faith and credit of the United States is on the line, which will cost 6 million jobs across America, increase interest rates on your home loans, your auto loans, and your credit cards, whatever it may be. This is not good for anyone, not anyone in any corner of America. And I believe that the what's holding this back in the Senate is the filibuster, which says that you have to have 60 votes, not just a majority of votes, which is 51, to be able to fix this. My colleagues in the House, led by Brendan Boyle out of Pennsylvania, he's a U.S. representative, incredible leader, well thought of. He has a package that would just fix this legislatively. One way or the other, this authority should go to the president, and then it could come back to the Senate for affirmation or whatever it may be. But that's what this should be. So that way, it's not about the political nonsense that is jeopardizing the full faith and credit of the United States.
Senator Ben Ray Lujan, I know you have to move on. You're very busy. We appreciate you and your efforts to always talk to the people of Southern New Mexico on KRWG.
Always an honor, Fred, and I look forward to seeing you down in Las Cruces here in the near future. You
great.
Take care.
Looking forward to it. Bye-bye.
Take care.
KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino. Thanks so much for being with us. With cold weather just around the corner, people experiencing homelessness are getting housing help in Las Cruces. The 40-unit Desert Hope Apartments is a permanent supportive housing development. More from Roz Brown at the New Mexico News Connection.
Some of the 40 units at Desert Hope are still open for leasing, according to Executive Director Nicole Martinez. She says federal pandemic tax credits have made a difference in how local communities can help those who need housing.
And I think it's really shone a light on how quickly that can happen for people, and that homeless prevention funding is something that needs to stay on the radar, as it had not been before.
Martinez notes Las Cruces is just cracking the surface with its additional 40 units. To qualify to live there, tenants must be verified as chronically homeless and have a permanent disability. In early 2021, the Department of Housing and Urban Development reported that for the first time in many years, homelessness among veterans and families did not improve over the previous year. Martinez has worked to end the cycle of homelessness for 15 years and says at least 1,000 more people have been served since the pandemic began. She says adequate resources can make a huge difference for anyone on the brink of homelessness, but she's worried about what the future holds.
We anticipate seeing more people that aren't able to piece things together, or as rental relief and things like that start to dry up.
She adds community partnerships will allow quarterly healthcare screenings along with nutrition and budgeting classes for people living at Desert Hope in an effort to help them transition out of homelessness. More information is online at mbpha.org. This is Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection.
From housing aid to food aid, Southern New Mexico's largest food pantry will be receiving $3.75 million from the city of Las Cruces to help with a warehouse restoration project aimed at expanding services. In depth, here's Madison Staten.
The Las Cruces City Council is supporting an expansion of the Casa de Peregrinos food program, authorizing $3.75 million to help with warehouse restoration efforts. Money for the project will come directly out of the city's Telshore Fund, which accumulated approximately $11.2 million in interest during fiscal year 2021. In addition, $3.9 million in legislative grant funding will also help to cover the estimated $7 million project cost. City Housing and Neighborhood Services Manager Natalie Green says the project will add additional freezer and refrigerator space, as well as storage for dry goods. Beyond that, plans include the installation of a demonstration kitchen, as well as new programming efforts.
The new programming at the facility would include a homebound delivery program for seniors and clients with disabilities. And then my favorite is the food pharmacy. So physicians can prescribe or refer clients who are newly diagnosed with metabolic disorders like diabetes or hypertension, and they can come learn about better food choices and then have access to that programming.
The new warehouse space, formerly the site of Horse and Hound Feed and Supply, sits directly next to the current Casa de Peregrinos location on the Mesilla Valley Community of Hope campus. In 2020, Casa de Peregrinos distributed 4.7 million pounds of food, more than nine times over the design capacity. Casa de Peregrinos Executive Director Lorenzo Alba Jr. says a partnership between the food pantry and the city of Las Cruces will be beneficial for the entire community.
This isn't solely a Casa de Peregrinos project or a City of Las Cruces project. This is, in fact, a community project. It's going to benefit this community that so badly needs this. It's going to allow us to be innovative and allow us to share that same vision that the city is developing with doing something about what's going on with poverty in our community.
At 26%, New Mexico has one of the worst rates in the nation for child food insecurity. For children in Doña Ana County, City Housing and Neighborhood Services Manager Natalie Green says the situation is even more extreme.
In Doña Ana County, we have a post-COVID estimate of childhood food insecurity is 29%, and our childhood poverty rate is as high as 41% in the county.
During the meeting, the council also approved a $350,000 block grant agreement to help provide gap funding for the restoration. Councilor Tessa Beda-Stuvey voiced her support, emphasizing a need to continually address hunger within the city.
We need this type of programming in our community. It's something that we don't want to have to need, but we do. And to hope that we can get this project on its way as soon as possible so we can be providing more services for the community.
Natalie Green, the city's Housing and Neighborhood Services Manager, says the project aligns well with the city's strategic goal to become a food-secure community.
It would develop and support programs that provide assistance to our traditionally underserved populations, and it would help transform Las Cruces into a food-secure community with improved access to healthy food options.
The city is currently working to finalize project plans and aims for construction to start during the second half of this fiscal year. For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
To environmental news now, and a recent study from the Environmental Defense Fund has found hundreds of oil and gas operations releasing methane across the Permian Basin. Marfa Public Radio's Mitch Borden reports it's an ongoing problem in the oil fields spanning Texas and New Mexico, despite some companies pledging to cut emissions in the past.
In August, researchers flew across segments of the Permian Basin, which over the last decade has become America's most prolific oil field due to hydraulic fracking. In the 11-day survey, 900 methane leaks were found, some releasing over a metric ton of the potent greenhouse gas every hour. According to Nicole Saunders, who's with EDF, the survey's findings are a sign the federal government needs to curtail oil field emissions, especially if states like Texas refuse to take meaningful action.
At this time, when we're seeing state regulators in Texas really refusing to act to bring down these emissions in our state for our health and our climate, it's really time for this federal oversight on the Texas oil patch to kick in.
Even though some oil companies have pledged to cut emissions, Saunders believes more rules are needed to bring the industry in line. The United States Environmental Protection Agency is expected to announce new rules that will crack down on methane emissions this fall. I'm Mitch Borden in Marfa.
To commentary now, and some are expressing grave concerns about the Doña Ana County Crisis Triage Center that recently opened its doors. Here's commentator Peter Goodman.
Is our crisis triage center dangerously mismanaged? Several experienced RNs think so. It's run by RI internationally, specifically by Karina Diaz, a certified art therapist and a psychotherapist who nurses say micromanages RNs, though not herself a nurse. One RN, Freddy Hernandez, has such extensive experience that he's run facilities. He served on committees trying to make the CTC happen. He was vastly disappointed by the result, with which he worked some weeks as a temp early on. Hernandez was worried and doubted that county management knew the extent of the problem. He said Diaz lacked experience with such a facility. Quote, she didn't know what to order, when to order, or how things should go, unquote, but micromanaged people anyway. Quote, she'd sneak up on us and say, why are you talking? And you had to ask for permission to go to the bathroom, end quote. Hernandez warned Diaz she'd lose nurses, telling her she had to treat them like adults. psychiatric nurses are scarce. There are apparently few guests. One county official says the CTC's helping about 3.3 people a week. RN Pamela Field calls it, quote, a gross waste of taxpayers' money, end quote. Probably the most serious allegation is that the facility takes in people whose medical challenges require certain drugs be immediately available. Huge blood alcohol levels in patients can be a serious medical problem. Field declined a shift because she thought she'd have to deal with such a patient without the necessary drugs. RI says it acts ethically within the constraints of its license, which does not permit it to store controlled drugs on premises. However, it says that once its doctor, who I believe sees patients virtually through telehealth, prescribes specific meds for a specific patient, RI can procure the drugs. However, nurses worry that that process isn't fast enough and that Diaz fights to admit people who should be hospitalized. Nurses also say that Diaz, who's not qualified to direct nurses or handle controlled drugs, inserts herself where she shouldn't. One nurse said, "I'm scared for our county. They're going to wind up having some dire thing happen." RI says it will soon apply for a better license and be able to have controlled drugs ready on site. One man reportedly presented with congestive heart failure and serious fluid overload and anxiety. Diaz reportedly pushed to admit him to treat the anxiety, though his situation was medically dangerous and the CTC had neither an EKG machine nor meds to treat fluid overload. RI disagrees with this account. I just know some extremely qualified nurses want county management and citizens to hear what they've seen and want the CTC to succeed. Perhaps we should listen.
Peter Goodman's opinions are his own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KRWG or NMSU. RI International, the company that runs the Crisis Triage Center, denies the allegations in this commentary. You can read its response and the full column in this post at krwg.org. Fatal drug overdoses are skyrocketing, driven by synthetic opioids like fentanyl. And that potentially deadly drug has made it to our region, the last part of the U.S. to face the brunt of the opioid crisis. The Mountain West News Bureau's Madeline Beck reports.
It was 2018. Ashley Romero was 32. She was living in Grand Junction, Colorado, a smaller community known for mountain bike tourism, public land access, and beautiful rocky terrain. She had an 8-year-old son and a boyfriend.
She was dating someone, and he gave her a half of a little blue pill.
Andrea Thomas is her mother. She says it looked like a Percocet.
The pill was actually poisoned with fentanyl, or laced with fentanyl, and she died almost instantly.
Her boyfriend took the other half, also nearly died, and was revived, but he killed himself shortly after. These pills, also called Mexican Oxy, Blue Mexies, or Blues, contain the man-made opioid fentanyl. It's similar to morphine, but can be 100 times stronger. It can make you high, or if you have too much, stop your heart.
You hear of overdoses all the time, but the difference between what happened to my daughter and all of those stories that I heard about overdose before is that she didn't overdose. She was poisoned.
Thomas started the Voices for Awareness Foundation to help get out the word about these counterfeit pills, but still finds plenty of people who don't know.
I think that we need to be talking about this everywhere. I think that it should be in the schools. I think going into college.
And she says we need action now. Fentanyl and similar synthetic opioids are driving increasing overdose deaths. CDC estimates show Colorado had a 133% increase in overdose deaths from synthetic opioids last year. Other Mountain West states have seen similar increases. So how do these fentanyl pills get here? Steve Katecki is with the Drug Enforcement Administration's Denver office. He explains that fentanyl and fentanyl-related substances often start with precursor chemicals in China that get shipped to Mexico.
And then down in Mexico, it's manufactured in a garage or a warehouse or, you know, something else down there by the cartels, is manufactured and then smuggled up through the southwest border.
Mexican cartels like fentanyl because it's cheap and powerful, but it's hard to mix in a way that's safe. An amount similar to a few grains of sand can be enough to kill. Doctors use it on patients every day, but they have instruments to give exact doses. Kateki's wife had it after giving birth.
Fentanyl is great for pain management, you know, and it has helped a lot of people get through some really rough times.
But the DEA says about a quarter of fentanyl pills they seized had enough of the substance to kill. And when I say fentanyl, I mean an umbrella of drugs, which includes carfentanil, something used in elephant tranquilizers. It can stop your heart in seconds.
I've been telling people it's like playing Russian roulette with a four-chamber revolver.
Cartels are pressing the fentanyl into pills that look like Oxycontin and Percocet, and that's for a reason. The U.S. cracked down on opioid prescriptions, but many people still want them. And Kateki says the amount of fentanyl coming over the border has doubled every year for the last 4 years. Now, it's everywhere.
This is a problem that has reached every corner of our communities.
Jess Stenna is a sergeant with the Idaho State Police. He's in Kootenai County in North Idaho, which has about 170,000 people, the city of Coeur d'Alene, and plenty of forest. Over 8 days this summer, that county had 5 unrelated overdose deaths, all suspected to have been fentanyl-related.
It's a problem that we have to combat. We can't just turn a blind eye to it.
That problem includes some people using painkillers to feel better or to simply not feel sick anymore. And kids experiment with these drugs, too.
We've had as young as 15-year-olds here overdose. The availability of it is frightening.
Stennett hopes people understand that if they didn't get a pill from a pharmacist, it could be their last. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Madeline Beck.
Funding for the Mountain West News Bureau provided in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Madeline Beck will be back with part two of her special report later in this program. Back to local news now, and the Las Cruces Public Schools plans to use over $64 million in American Rescue Plan Act grant funding to maintain COVID-safe operations and in-person learning. In depth, here's Madison Staten.
The Las Cruces Public Schools Board of Education unanimously approved an American Rescue Plan Act grant application totaling over $64 million. Of that $64 million, 20% will be allocated to address learning loss, a New Mexico Public Education Department requirement. LCPS Executive Director of Federal Programs, Carla Reagan, says the other 80% will be directed toward district needs, like instructional resources and PPE.
The funding for this will be used to help schools to return safely to in-person instruction, maximize in-person instructional time, sustain the safe operation of schools, and address the academic, social, emotional, and mental health impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic on New Mexico's students.
More than $5.3 million will be set aside for instructional staff salaries and benefits, while over $4.8 million is being budgeted for non-instructional staff. The largest chunk of funding, a little over $13 million, is being directed toward instructional resources. Reagan says this includes money for extended learning time.
Where we look at that extended learning time, whether it's after school programs or looking at extending time in the summer, whatever we decide, you know, to do as a district, there's funds in here to support that. The other big thing that is going to be something exciting and different that we're looking at with this is the work-based learning and career pathways that are in this area as well.
LCPS board member Teresa Tenorio advocated for COVID sick leave to be addressed.
I feel like that's something that's kind of been overlooked, especially for employees at LCPS who are in their first year. We have a lot of new hires. A lot of these employees, and if they have their own small children or even students who can't be home alone, if one of them gets quarantined, then the employee gets quarantined. And I just find it problematic that we don't have some kind of support for them.
LCPS Chief Financial Officer Ed Ellison says the COVID sick leave policy within the district has been addressed, emphasizing it will remain in place through at least the end of the fiscal year for all LCPS employees.
The district has extended that COVID sick leave. And so we do have the COVID sick leave in place, which is the 80 hours. So last year when the federal government put that in place, we voluntarily extended that to the end of the year. And it's also currently in place for this fiscal year.
In a public survey garnering over 1,300 responses, top priorities highlighted by students, parents, staff, and other community members included providing additional technology and supplies, which more than $8.7 million is being budgeted for, and increasing and retaining teaching staff. LCPS board member Pamela Court says the district should seek to involve more students in the budgeting process and be transparent about how money is being utilized within schools.
I suggest maybe going through the student advisory, the advisory classes in the middle schools and the high schools, creating a lesson. I think it's really important for the students to know the money that's coming in and where that money is going and how that money should be used. And I think it would be an awesome advisory lesson, at least for middle school and high school.
Other ways the grant funding is slated to be used include $12.5 million for HVAC replacements and upgrades, as well as $6.3 million for outdoor learning spaces and playgrounds. For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
Well, speaking of the pandemic, on the Health Watch this week, a question: is a good diet one of the weapons against COVID-19? KRA's Sam Baker talked about this with registered dietitian Rachel Trammell from the Parkland Hospital System in Dallas.
Your nutrition status definitely contributes to your immune system and how well it works. And it's an important strategy in helping us to maybe not necessarily stop us from getting COVID, but definitely impact the severity, most likely. Of course, we don't know for sure because there haven't been studies about all of these things. But we do know nutrition status does impact our body's ability to respond to infections, viruses, and things like that.
What could a person do to strengthen their immune system?
Making sure that you're eating a balanced diet is number one. Proteins and starches and vegetables and fruits at all of your meals can contribute different vitamins, micronutrients. Getting them from your food is a really good idea.
Is there any particular vitamin that stands out?
The main vitamins that we've heard most about are things like vitamin D3, vitamin C, zinc. Vitamin D3 is a very important vitamin in supporting our immune system, but when we eat foods that have vitamin D, usually it is required to be converted into the active form by getting sunlight during the day and things like that. But you can also take a supplement of vitamin D3, but we want to make sure that we're having a dual approach, right? We're wanting to get foods that have vitamin D, like mushrooms, and also, if needed, take a supplement.
I have to ask, because I understand that you've had a bout with COVID.
Yes, I got COVID in late December, and it has been a very rough road, I'm not going to lie. I've got a lot of things going on, and, you know, I was pretty well nourished, doing a lot of supplementation before I got COVID. That's probably why I did not get more severe COVID. I did have a severe case of COVID, and I'm struggling with long COVID, wondering if it's going to end anytime soon. But, you know, as far as long COVID goes, there are so many different theories and everyone is so different. So a lot of people are having different experiences, but there are a lot of recurring themes, which is very interesting.
The reason I was asking, I was just curious how what you know about nutrition is helping you through all of this.
I think the main thing that is helping me is having a balanced approach. Things like eating consistently, getting a good amount of vitamins and minerals from your food. If you can't necessarily eat, then drinking protein shakes, things like that. And also trying to get outside because of the sunlight. It helps your mental health as much as it helps the rest of your health. That being said, we know beyond a shadow of a doubt that everyone who has COVID has an inflammatory problem. Sometimes the inflammation attacks different parts of your body. One thing that is very important if you do have long COVID is to approach your food with an anti-inflammatory mindset. Reducing things like added sugars, reducing super starchy, ultra-processed foods, reducing the sugary drinks and things like that will really help your body be able to calm down any inflammation that exists and or just not contribute more inflammation to a problem that already exists.
So paying attention to this isn't a cure. Right. But it's, what, maybe one tool in the arsenal?
Yes, you're right. I wish there was a magic fix. I would buy it right now.
So if you have not had COVID, then is this another great excuse to maintain that balanced diet?
Eating an anti-inflammatory diet is going to help you no matter what. It's also going to help you if you happen to get COVID and you have not been eating an inflammatory kind of high sugar, high starch kind of diet. So it's definitely going to help you. Now, do we want to be obsessed with the foods that we're eating and kind of trying to plan every single thing and freak out about, you know, not having something that we want? Not necessarily. You know me, I'm always going to tell you it's a balance. You want to like make sure that you're maintaining good balance in every area of your life, including the food that you eat.
Rachel Trammell, thank you for being with me.
Thank you, Sam. It's good to talk with you.
KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino. Great to be with you on this Saturday evening. The group Commission Shift has released a series of reports spotlighting conflicts of interest among officials charged with regulating the oil and gas industry in Texas. Its first release focuses on the finances of one of the Texas Railroad Commission's three commissioners and proposes major changes. Marfa Public Radio's Mitch Borton has more.
As one of the heads of the Texas Railroad Commission, Christy Craddock is tasked with regulating the oil and gas industry. But can she do that fairly when she owns oil and gas assets worth more than $1.5 million? The answer is no, according to Virginia Palacios, executive director of Commission Shift, a nonprofit dedicated to holding the state's oil and gas regulator accountable.
What we're seeing here is that there are situations where the commissioners have a financial interest encouraging them to make decisions that may not be in the public's interest.
In the past, Craddock has said she is transparent about her investments in the oil and gas sector and adheres to Texas ethic laws. Commission Shift is recommending reforms to the Railroad Commission's conflict of interest policy, such as commissioners divesting from the oil and gas industry and limiting campaign contributions. I'm Mitch Borden in Marfa.
Well, early voting is underway for the municipal elections that take place on November 2nd. Many are reminding people to vote in Las Cruces and other municipal elections, including commentator Walt Ruppel.
Every 4 years, Americans flock to the polls in droves to elect a new president. Last year, more than 155 million people cast their ballots. 2 years later, we have the midterm elections, where we elect a new governor, and all members of both the state and U.S. House are up for re-election. In odd-numbered years like this one, we get the ugly stepchild of the electoral system, municipal and school board elections. Unlike the big national campaigns that make themselves impossible to ignore, local elections can sneak up on you. Early voting started October 5th for this year's election, which will be held on November 2nd. Seats on the Las Cruces City Council, Las Cruces Board of Education, and the Doniana Soil and Water Conservation Board will be at stake, as well as similar boards in smaller towns throughout the county. This will be a transitional election for the City Council, with two members stepping down to seek other positions. Gil Sorg will be running for a spot on the Soil and Water Board, while Gabe Vasquez will be looking ahead to the 2022 election, where he plans to challenge Representative Yvette Harrell for her seat in Congress. Local elections can be a lot more challenging for voters. Because the elections are nonpartisan, voters don't have the crutch of simply casting their ballots for the R or the D. And there won't be a lot of TV ads helping the candidates introduce themselves to voters. There are a lot of candidates this year running for the first time. That can make it tough for voters to make an informed decision. Both KTAL LP 101.5 FM Community Radio and KRWG TV are hosting candidate forums that will be available online. Local newspapers will also help provide information. And one of the best resources for voters is the candidate's own website, where the message is always unfiltered. Local elections may be more challenging for voters, but they're worth the effort. Decisions made by the local city council and school board have a much more immediate and more direct impact on our daily lives than the edicts that flow down from Washington, D.C. The Las Cruces City Council increased the minimum wage for local workers before the state did. We're still waiting on Congress. They were also ahead of the state and feds in banning plastic bags. The Las Cruces School Board drew protests this year when it changed its curriculum in an attempt to make it more inclusive for students of all cultures and nationalities. Several parents expressed concern that the change would lead to an indoctrination of students and to a belittlement of the dominant culture. We have the power to shape these critical decisions moving forward by voting this year. With this week's commentary, I'm Walt Rubel.
Walt Rubel's opinions are his own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KRWG or NMSU. Part two of our special report now. Our region has seen a spike in overdose deaths involving the powerful drug fentanyl. And often, people take a very small amount of the drug without understanding the dangers. The Mountain West News Bureau's Madeline Beck has our report.
Jonathan Ellington grew up in Covington, Kentucky, playing sports like soccer. His dad, Dave Ellington, says he never met a stranger and was a good student. When he was a junior in high school, though, his dad said he had a knee injury.
Long story short, there was, through the medications that were prescribed, the oxycodone, he became addicted to painkillers.
But he got clean, and then he headed out west to Colorado. He loved skiing. He ended up working at the historic Jerome Hotel in Aspen, built in 1889 and visited by the rich and famous like Hunter S. Thompson. But then Jonathan broke his hand and got back on painkillers, and he bought some from the wrong person.
It was in a bottle that was a medication bottle, as if it came from a pharmacy. It had a person's name on it, the person that actually sold him that.
They weren't painkillers, but fentanyl pressed into pills that looked like oxycodone. It was 2017. Jonathan died at the age of 30.
Basically, it took very, very little, and he died very, very quickly.
Fentanyl can be 50 to 100 times as potent as morphine. Police found the man behind the pills, Bruce Holder. His case highlights a new way prosecutors are going after fentanyl crimes. They found he trafficked thousands of pills from Mexico and had his wife and kids deal them, even though he knew they were fentanyl and were killing
people. Holder continued to distribute, and this continued even after his arrest in August of 2018.
Holder was found guilty of conspiring to distribute fentanyl, resulting in death. He faces a mandatory minimum sentence of 20 years and could be locked up for life. His sentencing is in October. Matt Kirsch is the acting U.S. attorney for the District of Colorado. He says these kinds of convictions spring from a federal law they started using a decade ago.
The first couple that we did were actually against healthcare professionals. And more recently, we have been using the tool against street dealers.
But he says they really want information on who's supplying the dealers. If they get it, dealers could get a shorter sentence.
Hello.
Hi. Are you the guy I'm talking to?
I'm Jason.
Jason Sawyer is a sergeant with the Drug Task Force of the Grand Junction Police Department. We sat at a table in a conference room behind a maze of hallways and locked doors. He says his department is one of the many looking more closely at fentanyl overdoses.
We've started, in the last year, maybe two, started investigating them as homicides or manslaughter type investigations.
Sawyer says homicide investigations take more resources. Instead of 1 or 2 hours, it can take 6 to 8 hours to process a crime scene. But he hopes if dealers face stiff consequences for fentanyl deaths, they'll be more careful about what they sell.
The people that are dealing it are the ones that make the impact in several people's lives.
However, some question whether law enforcement or courts should be involved at all. The Drug Policy Alliance is a nonprofit based in New York that advocates for an end to the drug war. Emily Kaltenbach is the senior director in their New Mexico office, the state that has had the largest problem with opioids in the Mountain West. She says police shouldn't be charging drug dealers like they'd charge murderers.
Who is that going to impact? It's going to impact communities that have been the focus of the drug war for decades.
That is, low-income communities and communities of color. And Kaltenbach argues arresting people doesn't stop the flow of fentanyl.
All it does is it cuts off that one piece of supply and another one pops up. Supply and demand does not change with increased sentencing.
Of course, this is part of the larger discussion nationally about what law enforcement's role should be when it comes to mental health and substance abuse. But one thing is certain. Fentanyl is a problem that's only getting worse. Recently, Wyoming officials seized about $150 million worth of fentanyl being driven through that state in one shipment. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Madeline Beck.
An update now on a regulatory story we have been following for months. An official recommendation is expected soon over a proposed merger between New Mexico's public service company, PNM, and Connecticut-based utility Avangrid. Many opponents testified at hearings, including current Avangrid customers from other states. They warned of high bills, power outages, and inadequate customer service should the Public Regulation Commission greenlight this merger. Here's Roz Brown from the New Mexico News Connection.
Utility company PNM says it can provide the state with more renewable energy by merging with Avangrid, a Connecticut-based subsidiary of an international energy conglomerate in Spain. Some don't believe that, including Representative Seth Berry, a state legislator in Maine.
I can tell New Mexico definitively Avangrid doesn't care about New Mexicans or the environment any more than the wolf cares about Little Red Riding Hood.
If the multi-billion dollar deal is approved, Avangrid would get more than 500,000 New Mexico customers, and its access to PNM would help the company to fulfill its goal of exporting power to other markets, such as Mexico and California. Rebecca Hasso Aguilar at the University of New Mexico has studied privatization of utilities. She's raised concerns about energy reliability and rates, as well as Avangrid's questionable track record.
I know the work of this company in Mexico, and I know of the work of this company in Latin America. I know its reputation, and I wouldn't want that happening in New Mexico.
New Mexico is among the top three states for solar power potential, and the Biden administration aims to reach 45% solar energy nationwide by 2050. Berry notes that Avangrid has resisted offering Maine residents and businesses rooftop and community solar at every turn.
They have been the number one obstacle to creative, innovative, local grid solutions and to making the grid of the future that we all need.
This is Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection.
Well, of course, broadband is now considered an extremely important utility and something that a lot of people are talking about, including Congress, which is debating two infrastructure bills. Of course, there is money already to try to expand internet service, and a countywide survey began last week to expand internet access in Doña Ana County. Resident participation is needed so that Doña Ana Broadband, a multi-agency collaborative, can work on connecting households and businesses throughout the county. Emily Guerra spoke with County Communications Coordinator Lucy Rubio about the importance of this survey.
What is the difference between internet access and broadband? Is it the one and the same?
We use it interchangeably. I am not a technical person, so I wouldn't be able to explain the technicalities of it. And I think it would take us a couple of hours to understand it for us who are not familiar with it. But we can use it interchangeably in this case, because what they have to build is broadband access. What it will give us access to is being able to use the internet.
There's a new multi-agency who's collaborating to connect all county residents, Doña Ana Broadband. What is that, it, and how are they accomplishing this?
That's correct. So the county is participating in this Doña Ana Broadband multi-agency group to help connect the whole county. You know, there are efforts in every county and every city, it seems, and throughout New Mexico. I'm sure people have heard about legislation that has been passed and monies that are being set aside to help connect everyone with broadband, but it doesn't happen by magic. It takes a whole community, and it's taking a really big group of us working together to do different parts that pertain, that are within our scope, within our area of influence, and within our area of work in order to get the whole connection to work. Let me give you an example. In Doñana County, there are two of us working on it almost every week. We do a little something. And one of the things we did was partner with New Mexico's IT department, the Information Technology Department. They built an instrument to survey our whole county, and we are promoting the survey so that all the residents and all the businesses in our county participate and help us map out. So what we have right now is a very blurry picture that's been reported by others as to what, who has access, how fast is it, and where are we lacking access. And this survey will enable us to paint a much more clear picture with many more little dots. Where Emily lives and has access, it has this fast of an access. And where Lucy lives, there's a difference, right? And this will help us build a plan. So first we need to do the survey. First we need to paint the picture or plan out the map of where we're going. And this will enable us to build a plan that helps us plan out where could we do something, a quick change that will really make Emily's connection much faster along with her neighborhood. Or where do we need a bigger investment because there's really no connection. They don't have the last mile and there's all this terminology, but if there's no nearby service that could be possible, then we need to start from scratch. What can we do to help those very underserved communities in order to connect them? That's why we need everyone to answer the survey, because we don't know what we don't know. And this survey, unlike any survey you've taken before, will help us build a stronger, more robust plan that helps you and your neighborhood.
Going back to the multi-agency, you mentioned the state of New Mexico. What other agencies are involved in Doñana Broadband? This isn't an agency or the broadband service of Doñana County. Can you explain that?
Correct. We call it Doñana Broadband Group because we're working countywide, but it is taking a group of people that is making very likely allies out of us, but it includes NMSU, the Doñana Community College. The El Paso branch of the Dallas Fed is helping us with technical assistance and leadership training for us to help us accelerate our progress in connecting everyone and doing away with the digital divide. The Health and Human Services and Facilities Departments of the county are helping us. The City of Las Cruces is partnering with us too. In fact, the Digital El Paso is a group that is very similar to Doñana Broadband, and we partner with them to talk to El Paso Electric, who is also helping us promote the survey in other groups.
Now, once this survey is done, how are you going to help the community? Who is going to be able to receive access to the internet?
So once the survey is closed on November 19, all the data is going to be in aggregate, plotted on a map, so that we can develop a feasibility study. The feasibility study is going to let us look at what businesses can be enhanced, so what residential areas can be quickly helped, and what would it take? What kind of a connection service? Is it satellite? Is it underground fiber? Is it a combination? What would make us get there quicker with the least amount of money and connect the highest number of people? But in order to do that, first we need the map, right, to get there.
You can hear the full conversation with Lucy Rubio about that internet survey on the Puentes page. It's under the news tab at krwg.org. Broadcasting from New Mexico State University, KRWG Las Cruces, and KRXG Silver City. I'm Fred Martino. That's KRWG News this week. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.